Which, if you take the subway, is maybe around 30 minutes or so. It's on the way to Danshui, which I've talked about before. Now, why are we in Beitou? No, I'm not going to be heading to a hot spring. Well, maybe at the end of the show, but I am rather here. I'm rather, I should say, sitting with somebody who is well known to the international shortwave audience, especially for those who have been listening for more than 20 years, and that is David Monson, who for many years hosted Brussels Calling, as well as a number of other programs. And the interesting thing is that he is not too far from where Happy Station is being produced now, which is Banqiao Taipei, which I've talked about before. Well, sitting in front of me is the man himself, David Monson. Hello, David.
Well, Keith, my gosh, what an imagination you have, really. You've taken away all my best lines. You know, what's the point in going on with this interview? Yes, it is. You remind me. Gosh, it is. Is it as long as that? About half a century ago, that's right, when I actually did host the program. What was it called again?
You know what's really funny about this is I had no idea that you were here because I had listened to you many years ago when I was very young. But a mutual friend of ours, Bob Zanotti in Switzerland, and Jeff White, who's the manager and owner of WRMI, our Happy Stations Relay, said, you know, David Monson is in Taipei. And I went, that's very odd indeed. But before we get to how you ended up in Taiwan, because that's probably a whole show in itself. You were at Brussels Calling, but you're not originally from Belgium. You are actually South African.
Well, I mean, I'm kind of half and half. You know, I've always been a schizophrenic in a way. I'm a bit of a split personality, and you know, and very much kind of. Yes, I am a little mixed up in that sense of the word, in having had what is it, an Anglo-Dutch German background. I dropped to earth in South Africa, as many people know, but I have, of course, European or Belgian nationality. I almost feel, though, I've lived out in the East so long now, where I came more by accident than design, rather like yourself, I suppose. You know how these things happen. And where I've made my own small contribution to 5,000 years of Chinese civilization. Here's Ali. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, this, by the way, is David's son, Ali, who actually is learning the piano. Say hello, Ali.
Hello.
There he is with the hello. But David.
Would you believe it? I mean, that wasn't around like 50 years ago, right, when I was broadcasting your
So let me
Brussels
ask you,
Calling.
how did you end up in Belgium working for Belgium Radio International?
Well, my gosh, it's so long ago, I can hardly remember. You must remember, you know, Keith, that I am getting on in years now. Oh, my God, not quite as old as some of my your illustrious previous guests on the show, you know, like, can I mention any?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
No. We're all in the same league, basically, as far as ages go now, aren't we? Yes, very much yesteryear. But not exactly past tense. Not exactly past tense yet, certainly. I don't feel that way. And this is an exciting place to be, as you well know. How did I get here? Well, I
No,
tell you.
not here in Taipei, but to to Belgian radio, to Belgian radio.
Memory's going now, you see that. But how did I get to Belgian radio? Well, that is a long story. More, once again, more by chance than anything else. I mean, I took a trip to, I was about to take a slow trip to, you know, a slow trip to China, I suppose, even at that stage. And, you know, Europe is just over there, over the channel in those days. And I went to Germany, where I thought I might have had some connections, some contacts with Germany from when I worked. Not many people realize this, but I did work for a short time for the old South African Broadcasting Corporation. And I ended up, why don't I can say it, heavens alive, there's nothing to lose now, is there? Like a job at, you know, the art, the old Dachister Radio and Smelly Visi, television, sorry, right? And very, 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 very much by chance. I was just telling my son that the other day. He asked me the same question, Ali did. How did you end up in Belgium of all godforsaken places? Actually, I've got a lot of good things to say about Belgium, too.
Yeah, but we're talking about Belgian radio here.
Belgian radio, you're talking about Belgian radio. Well, not many good things to say about them, but no, the fact is, it did give me a breakthrough in Europe. And Belgian radio, I went to Germany, and I got sidetracked in Germany somehow. I met a guy that said he'd worked for Belgian radio, and never told this story before, and said, you know, hey, David, you know, it might be, why don't we, since you're looking for a place to stay tonight, why don't we shack up together? I was young and innocent, and it didn't occur to me that, you know, maybe he wanted to, take my purse or whatever. But he disappeared, completely disappeared, and it only cost me 50% of what I should have paid for the room or the hotel. And very nice of him, he footed up the bill, he'd pay the following morning. I went out, never saw this guy again, but he had told me in that very, in the couple of hours that I spoke to him that, you know, there was possibly a chance of a job in Belgium on the radio job. So I doubled back to Belgium in the middle of the night, slept on the station, and good Lord, this is an awful long time ago, isn't it? And called them the following morning and had an interview, and because I spoke Dutch, all the South African former Dutch, not very well understood most other places, but I understand it still is in Patagonia of all places, can you believe, they speak Dutch or Afrikaans. But I spoke the lingo, and they seemed to be impressed, and they said, well, listen, there might just be a place for you at Belgian Radio, but don't call us, we'll call you. Well, I mean, that's just, you know, you...
That's a standard line that you hear,
standard,
yeah.
Standard line, and I thought... You know, I'll just go back to, I went back to Britain, London, where I was at that particular time resident, and thoroughly enjoying myself. There was absolutely no reason for my radio to leave London. But I wanted to get back into broadcasting, which I'd done in Africa at a very young age. And I'd traveled, I'd been invited even at the age of 19 when I kicked off in broadcasting, I was invited on a extended trip to Europe by an international airline, name shall be nameless. It wasn't South African Airways. I thought, heaven's alive, this is an opportunity I can't miss. So when the call did come, they called me, amazing enough. And that's how I came to be working for Belgian Radio at that time.
So when you started at Belgian Radio, what kind of things did they have you doing? Were you just a regular features producer and just reading news every now and again, or did they say, oh, we want you to take over this show?
There was no newscast at that particular time. It was a program, a tippity program, about 10 minutes long, called Brussels Calling, I think.
So it was 10 minutes?
Only 10 minutes, yes, when I joined them. And it became, I had a wonderful colleague, a lady which some of the shortwave listeners might well remember, Jackie Marshall. She used to call herself Jackie Marshall. She's still going strong, my heavens. She's in her mid-80s now, and she's still a wonderful friend of mine. Her daughter, who is just about my age, or perhaps just 1 year older, we saw her just a couple of months ago in Europe. And I was very happy to be able, a couple of years ago, to meet up with Jackie again, who lives out in the country, and hopefully when I'm next in Europe, who knows when that will be, I will have the opportunity to see her again. But the fact is, they did. I co-produced this 10-minute program, which I edited as well. And it was basically just an interview a day, a subject a day kind of thing, which we slowly expanded, or gradually expanded over a year or a couple of years that I was, those initial years, we expanded into eventually a 20-minute program and then a half-an-hour program, a 30-minute program. I don't think it ever really got any longer than that, you know. Certainly not by the time I left. Maybe it did when it eventually became Radio Flanderen, right, I think, because I lost touch altogether.
But the thing that was interesting about it, when I've listened to some old recordings of Brussels Calling, it is very different from what a lot of other European shortwave broadcasters were doing at the time. I mean, well, especially probably because of your personality as well. I mean, it didn't sound, let's say, as stiff as Deutsche Welle or as, you know, stuff shirt, you know, suit and tie BBC.
Well, do I look, you know, stuffed shirt BBC or Deutsche Welle or what? No. Well, I mean, that wasn't intentional. I used to listen to some of these stations, you know, and I appreciated the content. It was just something that evolved, I suppose, the spontaneousness, the spontaneity of the program, I suppose. And I'm just about as human as you are, Keith, and I think you're doing much the same thing with Happy Stations. You know, it's a lot of improvisation. And I guess that's the sort of person I am. So very quickly, I realized that almost intuitively that, you know, people don't want to, or listeners don't want to sit out there listening to stuffed chats, and you know, whether it's the BBC, Deutsche Welle, or any one or the other, you know, then official government-run or sponsored radio stations. So it turned into a very informal, as you know, if you listen to it, very informal program. And I was very happy to eventually come around to producing, or to every day, or presenting the mailbag program, because this really brought me into mailbag, which was then just a simple mailbag. You know, it's merely sending off QSL cards, I think you call them, right, to DX listeners around the world, and just responding to a letter. But it became more than that. It became almost an interactive as you could be in those days, you know.
So when you were doing the show for Belgian Radio, how much of a free hand did you have? Or was there a lot of pressure from management to say, oh, David, you know, tone it down, you know, this is Belgium, we're Belgian Radio International, try to make it sound more official. Was this kind of pressure on you?
Well, it's amazing that you asked me that question, because there was one. I can say it all now, heavens alive. I mean, I'm not likely to lose my job at Belgian Radio any longer, because I did, simply because of what you say. I mean, yes, it was very, it did become very bureaucratic. It wasn't at the beginning. I mean, or was it? No, it was. I mean, we had people who were shunted into positions like you've worked for some of these stations, heavens alive, you know how it is. And I don't wish to sound, you know, kind of not sour grapes or vindictive or anything like that, because I'm not, quite obviously. I would have wished it to have been otherwise, but it was just a lack of imagination. You know, people just didn't have the imagination that it took, I think, to produce a shortwave radio program, because shortwave radio programs were just always, it seemed to me, stereotypically formal government kind of propaganda type, if you don't mind me saying that, you know, programs. And you know, they were dry and deadwood a lot of times, simply because they were being managed by deadwood. I'm, you know, pity to say that, but it's a fact, isn't it? And officials you know, so I you know, I just wanted it to sound something different, and I found that there was this almost immediate response from listeners to a more informal, spontaneous, and human approach. It's not to say that I was anti, you know, DXs or anything like that, because there were many DXs who responded in exactly the same way. There were also many, probably a lot of DXs who, in the final analysis, because we tried something different also in terms of arranging a convention back in 1980, the year the wall came down in Berlin?
1989.
Was it 1989? That's right. Did I have a show? Yes, we did. That's right. That was my last big event at the World Congress. What was it? The World Convention Center. International Convention Center, ICC in Berlin.
But you know, you were saying that, you know, Belgian radio became very bureaucratic, and they were putting pressure on you to, you know, to become more serious and all that. But didn't they realize that people were tuning in for a reason, or was that just not important to them?
I don't think they cared. Like many, they really didn't care. I can say that now, and I wish I was back there still working, you know, for in the interest of Belgium, because it's you know, I love so many of, there's so many. It's so much part of me. I mean, I spent so much time there, and I went to Belgium, quite honestly, and fell in love with the Flemish provinces, not for the reason many people do. When I tell people why I stayed and why I fell in love with the place, they kind of, you know, they kind of gasp. It was the light. It was the air. It was something ethereal about the place, the Flemish countryside, the mirage of the Flemish countryside. It's a very special atmosphere. You've been there, I know, haven't you? Yes, you lived in Holland for a while. We've been there. It was a, you know, a countryside, a Platteland, flat country, with that shimmering sunlight over it, you know, the mist that inspired great music, piano compositions. You know, that's another one of my interests, classical music, inspired compositions by composers like Ravel, for instance. So yeah, one of the reasons why I went there, and it sounds like a very obscure and perhaps rather offbeat reason for settling in a place, but that was certainly one of them. And you know, apart from the fact that I also, in other ways, I became kind of romantically, in more ways than one, kind of enmeshed in the place. And I loved what I was doing. I loved what I was doing at the radio. And I really genuinely loved the interaction with the listeners around the world, which there was. It was really living. So, but yes, the bureaucracy you talk about, of course, it was ever present. You know, there were ever people trying to tell me how to do it otherwise.
Mm-hmm. So when did it become, when did you realize that, you know what, they want to ruin this, they want to kill this? When did it start becoming a big problem?
Well, I suppose I don't want to mention any names, no pectoral. I don't, and really, I don't wish to sound any way, you know, bitter or twisted or bisted or vindictive. No, I just feel sorry that it turned out like that. That there were people who didn't understand how, not just because of what I was trying to do, but didn't understand the essence of broadcasting, the essence of live, real time broadcasting.
Well, you were telling me some funny stories that you would go in at like midnight to do Brussels calling, to do it live, which management didn't like. Would even transcribe the stuff that you were ad-libbing on air, which to me sounds kind of ludicrous.
Well, it's just as well you said that, because it might have sounded perhaps a little bit, when I look back now, I can laugh about it, but it actually did lead to a court case. It led to it also led, simply because a sabbatical on my part, I went away for 6 months, and you know, everybody thought it would all blow over. I disappeared for 6 months. But yes, there was constant monitoring. Everything I did was transcribed, because they didn't like what I said. Some of the time, the spontaneity of it all, because they were afraid. What they were afraid of, I don't know, because I could only have been saying positive things about Belgium, and certainly about the Flemish provinces, which I happen to represent, and the culture and the art and the music and everything that Europe and indeed Belgium is, kind of in a microcosm. You know, I always said, sorry Bob, you know, sorry the rest of you, that you know, Belgium, as I say, in a microcosm, the Flemish provinces, the art and the music sector, was a microcosm of European culture, and really a repository more than possibly almost any other small country in Europe. You know, Belgium was.
But for some reason, they didn't like that idea, which, you know, it's funny, because when I talk to people that worked in other international broadcasters, being it Deutsche Welle or Radio Netherlands or now Belgian Radio International, there seems to be this one period of time where management of all these stations sort of became lost. I mean, it's like a new management crew came in, they didn't know much about radio, and they kind of lost direction in what they wanted to do, and became to sound like one another, but they used to sound maybe different prior to that.
Well, they were just like a lot of what Europe has become, quite honestly, just bureaucrats. I mean, you know, they were just shunted into these positions. They were possibly some of the time toward, you know, ending their career and you know, and in other
let's
cases,
put the civil servant in the international service, he's going to retire soon.
That's the word, possibly, just civil servantees. And that's the way, I suppose, it was in many other stations as well. I mean, I certainly recognize that in some of the contact, the exposure that I had to a few other European stations, which I must say, when I left Belgian Radio, or even before I left, I was looking for another position. And to my great disappointment, I discovered even friends of mine, who people I thought were friends and that I knew as colleagues once, you know, had indeed themselves turned into, that they represented the system in the same way. And were demanding all the kind of, what would you call them? I mean, you know, I don't know how to exactly describe the people, the mentality. Maybe you said it best, you know, kind of bureaucrats or bureau rats or whatever they call them in Brussels these days, you know, but I've just been there. I've just been there. I mean, I just don't like what Europe has become. And maybe, you know, I lose any opportunity of ever going back. I'd love to sometimes. But that's the way the station has become. And I think it's very sad to realize, and people like you have told me, and I learn because I've been out here for so many years, just doing my own thing and trying to stay in business in one way or another. And you know, I realize that it hasn't become it. Shortwave broadcasting, I'm told, is dying, right? Or isn't, even as I myself believed, had died altogether. And then suddenly, you know, you pop up from nowhere.
Well, say, you know, there were some people when I said, "Oh, by the way, I met David Monson." People other than Bob Zanotti and Jeff White, they said, "Oh, he's still alive." I went, "Yes, he's very much alive."
Well, hopefully so, because you know, I might be something of a sexagenarian now myself. Yeah, forget about the prefix, but genarian, sexagenarian myself. Can you believe it? I mean, gee, my gosh, where have all those years gone? I mean, we all end up saying that, but. But, you know, I feel more alive and younger than I've ever felt, possibly.
But when you left...
Not fossilized like I think so much of Europe has become. Yeah.
But when you left Belgium, you then headed to Namibia.
Oh, you bring back memories again.
That's also an interesting story because...
See, I always fall out with the system. It doesn't matter where I am, I guess, right?
Well, let me ask you that because it's interesting because did you see yourself... as a rebel against the system? Were you one of those people? Like, I despise most station management. And it's come to a point where I said, like, okay, if they don't like if they want me to do the kind of show they want to do, which I don't like, I'm going to do my own thing.
Well, I just get very frustrated, you know, Keith. It's not that I just want to do my own thing. I'm prepared to sit down and listen and to there's an element of compromise, but I just felt that these people were visionless. They just had absolutely no idea. You know, of what, and what useful purpose, you know, this incredible, this magical medium could be for them and for the country. Because after all said and done, all communication is people to people, P to P, you know. Mm. I've been doing a lot of B to B stuff now, but I'm always a great, you know, believer in P to P, person to person, people to people, my gosh. And you know, they just didn't get it. And so, I got incredibly frustrated, and I wanted to walk all over them, you know. I mean, I could be. I am a rather hot-tempered sort of. I can be rather passionate, you know. I can't be dispassionate about anything, really. I was in love with this media. I was in love with this media, you know. And these people just obviously weren't. They were just, as you say, state.
Civil servants.
Maybe we get back to their word. And maybe there's still quite a number of these kind of radio stations around today. I mean, I had an example of this just a couple of weeks ago.
So when you left Belgium and you ended up in Namibia, how much time in between?
Oh, you asked me that question. I'm glad you did because, yeah, I wasn't there very long because I fell out very quickly too. I can say that, yeah. I was appointed chief announcer, cook and bottle washer, everything, yeah. a newsreader, program producer for what was then, I suppose, the Southwest African or Namibian, just going on becoming Namibian Broadcasting Corporation. I mean, even Jeff White, good old Jeff White. Hi, Jeff, if you're out there now. Yeah, you're still alive too, right? You're still around. And Jeff's a bit younger than me, my gosh, but I remember, yes, how well I remember Jeff. And he helped me a great deal. Of course, one of these conventions I cooked up latterly after I'd opened my own company. But we'll get back to that another time. What I want to say is in Namibia, I was broadcasting for 6 months, and that led to many things, including a couple of programs that I recorded, including one that Jeff's still going to dig out of his archives for me, right, on the Namibian desert, one of the best programs I think I ever made, right, which I used synchronized or what I did, kind of double up, used things like cadenzas from Rachmaninoff piano concertos, you know, to describe some of the wildlife or they call it the study of snakes, serpentology or something, right? in the desert. I had some incredible experience, some incredible material that I collected there.
You know, it's funny, I was transferring some of your old tapes for you and I came across that report by Jeff White and I sent the short clip to Jeff to listen to. And he wrote back, he said, you know, he remembers. He said he showed up at the station that day and they said they got this phone call from the guy David Monson in Namibia wanting to do a story on the wildfires. And you know, the funny thing is Jeff's voice still sounds the same.
Well, Jeff,
it sounds the same.
Well, Jeff never changes, does he? I mean, he pitched up here quite like Jeff always does, you know, like apparition suddenly from nowhere. He was attending some congress, some convention here, I think, and which he seems to be doing in different parts of the, you know, the diaspora.
But how did you follow with Namibian radio? Was it the same thing that had happened in Belgium, or was it a different circumstance?
Basically, because they like the Belgian radio, they also had monitors and spies, and you know, as I discovered, and that's the closest I think I got to fisticuffs with anybody in a studio. But then, you know, I suppose my old colleagues at Belgian radio might tell you that no, I never had that sort of a, you know, I only turned the director's table over once, the desk over once. I mean, that's as far as I got to. But certainly not with my colleagues, whom I was rather fond of. Yes.
You only threw a desk over. I once threw a metal reel at someone.
Good for you. No, if they're still listening, I think I cleared the desk. But if they're still listening, yeah, I was really rather fond of my colleagues. You know, we got on well together. But they had their jobs to keep, and, you know, they had the status quo had to be kept too. So I didn't expect to, you know, to follow me out the back door. But that was quite kind of nasty. It was rather bloody in the end, and no one, you know, no one wins in a case like that. Just no one wins, you know. I should have legally, I think, won the court case, because I went, no one had ever sued the Belgian radio before, I don't think so. But the funny thing is, I understood that there were people after me, that came in after me, and that started on national shows. I can't remember the guy's name, but he actually worked with me on my program. And in what was then the International Service, and then went kind of live on air, doing a morning show on the Belgian radio, or the Flemish radio service, I suppose, in Dutch. And he seemed to get away with it, you know. They didn't victimize or make a scapegoat out of him.
But, you know, you can actually say now that you've had the last laugh, because Belgian Radio International and Radio Vlaanderen, what it became, is gone. They are now gone, deceased.
Well, that's such a pity. I mean, if they'd ever want me back, if they want me to revive that show again, I mean, I'd go back tomorrow and do that. Quite honestly, I'm not sure whether I'd work for the same, you know, people. But certainly, why? I mean, this is only Belgium, but other countries have done the same thing. But why? They have so much to talk about. I mean, you know, and the whole world. You know, Dutch is my, basically could be my mother language, because half of me is kind of Anglo-Dutch, English, and a bit of, I don't know, everything else. I'd like to say that, you know, a small percentage of me was Zulu or Khoisan or something as well. You know, it might have made my passage to the world a lot easier, certainly today, you know, thinking about what geopolitically the world has become. But for all that, yes. It was the way it is. That's the way it was, and that's the way it went. But such a pity, because so much could have been, so much was lost. I mean, people used to say to me, "Gosh, David, what a waste! You know, you're out in the wilderness now." And I never made any kind of comeback. I would have liked to have done that in the international radio and on the short, whether it was on the short waves or not, because I then took the line that by definition, today, certainly in our digital day and age, in era, you know, every you'd say FM station is an international broadcaster. It could be, but it's not quite the same thing, is it? Listening to, I have a digital radio, which I can connect to the internet, and I can listen to any one of 1,000 stations around the world. You know, so can you, FM stations, but it's just not the same.
You know, but at the same time, there's something you mentioned that's interesting is, and I've talked about this with other people, I think that the problem that international shortwave broadcasting has faced, I mean, there's been challenges from many areas. Of course, technology has changed. Communism in Europe no longer exists. The Berlin Wall is down. But at the same time, something that shortwave broadcasting had that it seems to be lacking now is programming, meaning good programming, very, you know, some even off-the-wall personalities, which seem to have disappeared. I mean, now when I listen to, let's say, Radio France International, Deutsche Welle, or any of the others from Europe, To me, they literally sound like carbon copies, and they're all trying to be like miniature BBCs. Anything special that they previously had is gone.
Well, what a pity. I mean, I really don't know how to answer that, Keith. I only know that, and I think it's very sad that this has actually been the case, because let's face it, I mean, 20, 30 years ago, there were some great guys out there, and we've mentioned a few of their names, and they were all trying to do the same thing, and they were all just as human as I ever was, I think, or try to be, or spontaneous, right? And maybe in some ways, you've heard my Mail and Mobile. I listened to that, and it's the first time in 25 years, I think, that I listened to that record. Thanks to you, that LP that I heard the other day, and I kind of cringe in embarrassment, you know, something cringe in embarrassment. But nevertheless, yes, it was all an effort and all part of the content and spontaneity of trying to make this a more spontaneous, more human medium. I mean, there was no, and I still today, I don't like television, quite honestly. Radio leaves so much more, and always will. The audio, the voice, leaves so much more to the imagination, doesn't it? And you're going to stop me now, Keith. I think I could stop for another glass of wine. I mean, you know. That I'm not here. I never had this opportunity before, because no one's ever interviewed me as you have and asked me about just this content. It doesn't mean to say just because a program like mine or like yours is spontaneous, is improvised to a certain extent, it doesn't mean that it's unprepared.
I know, let me ask you, because before you went into this, right. Because it seems that when I listened to the LP, which is Selections from Brussels Calling, and when you were doing the mobile shows around Flanders, did you come from a theatrical background? Because in many ways, they sound very theatrical. It sounds like you had, at some point, some type of theatrical training. I mean, how did you learn how to do this? Or was you like, well, I'm just going to talk and that's it?
No, I didn't have a theatrical training. Maybe I always have been a little theatrical in my life, but it's strange you should say that, because I would like very much to have had to have trained as a thespian, right? to have had, I talk too quickly, I still do. Even my students, one of the things I do today, I do some university lecturing, and my Chinese students always tell me, oh, please, sir, you know, call me professor. But sir, you talk too fast, you know, as I say, well, I'll slow down. I have learned to slow myself down. But I did. I would like to have walked the boards. I would like very much to have had a career on the stage for many reasons, and that was one of the most treasured memories of my life, in fact, were the years that I spent in London and being exposed to, of course, you know, the National Theatre, the Royal Shakespeare Theatre, and indeed I had interviews and even met up with, at one time, right here, isn't it amazing, in Taiwan, with one of the big names, in fact, in the Royal Shakespeare Company, who at that time was a South African. No names in Pectoral again, and she was horrified by Taipei. And I said, but you know, you don't know it as well as I do. But, you know, she came out here with the Royal Shakespeare Company quite years ago. And, you know, she actually, as a very young actress, I mean, I think she was most beautiful physically, and also I think even in temperament, people I'd ever seen on stage. And she had the role was Cordelia, the fair Cordelia, in King Lear. And this was one of our set books. I was only a teen, I must have been no more than 14 or 15 at the time. And even then, we had a headmaster who'd been also, who trained and educated in the UK, in England. So this was, once again, you know, just a magical thing for me. And then after all these years to actually meet her here. And so, yes, I've always been in love with the theatre.
The thing is, when you first went on air, how did you, when you think back now, the first time you went on air, do you think back and say, oh, that was awful, or what? I mean, how did you do? What were you thinking? I mean, what did you think in your head, how I want to come across?
No, I didn't, quite honestly. It wasn't. It was very much a subconscious thing. I think Kim Andrew Elliott once called it You remember him? Kim, hi Kim. No, once spoke about Stream of Consciousness. Yeah, that's right. Stream of Consciousness broadcasting. I really didn't think about it. It wasn't a conscious thing. It was just quite intuitive almost, you know. It just evolved, and I didn't... You know, people have asked me that question before. What was it like talking... Maybe there weren't millions. I like to imagine that maybe there were millions or hundreds of thousands or thousands or hundreds or just one. And that was the important thing. You were only talking to a single individual, you know, a single individual. And it had to come across as that. Like I'm talking to you now. I'm only talking to you. You know, I'm only talking to you. I'm not thinking about the millions of people out there. And I think that if you're actually able to get your whatever you're saying, then I think... If there's going to be any purpose in communication, I spend my life telling this now to my students, any purpose in communication and any purpose in radio, in entertainment, it is entertaining. It is entertaining, but it has to be at the same time, to a certain extent, educational. It has to, I think, too many, and I think that's the trouble with many of these radio stations, international radio stations, talking down to an audience. You don't do that. This is vertical. You know, it's got to be horizontal. There's got to be that human connection. And the only way you do that, you know, is not to talk up to, but to talk to, you know, to talk horizontally. And that's the way I always felt that broadcasting or communication should be. And certainly any communication that I was in any way actively and personally involved in, actively and interactively. And this is still the way it is. That's the way it was. And I talk about being prepared. You know, It is. I mean, you whatever you do is the sum total of everything you are, right? You were then, and even 5 minutes ago, or what you are now. And it all comes together at that precise moment of time. And I think you said something to me, very touching. I found it, and a great compliment. And maybe a few others have said that too. You mentioned it. Ex-colleague of yours, I think, in Radio Nederland, who seemed to think that when I came into a studio, I could cook up something. Oh, yeah. And say, well, how did she put it? She says, oh, well, I can't quite remember now. How did you put it?
Somebody at Radio Nederland told me, they said, David Monson was the, you know, when you listen to David Monson, he can show up in the studio, go on the air for maybe 30 minutes or 45 minutes or an hour or however long the show was, and make it sound as if he was preparing the entire week.
Well, it was not just the entire week, you know, it was all my life that had gone before that particular broadcast. I mean, it's my interests, your interests, you share, and you want to share your interests. You want to share the things that you're passionate about, right? Don't you? With your audience. And as we have already, Keith, in just the few weeks that I've known you, right? We shared so many like passions.
Yeah, it seems like a regular thing now is Sunday afternoon coffee.
Coffee after my... After my son's music lesson, right? After my son's music lesson, which is one of my passions. So even on shortwave radio, as some of the listeners might remember. And it's amazing the response I had to those classical music programs or the opportunity to play, which is something they didn't like either at Belgian Radio, I have to tell you, you know, classical music. Because obviously it loses a lot, you know, modulation and all the rest of it. But nevertheless, it was a way of making a connection with another listenership, another audience, you know. And I had some really amazing, cliches, amazing, but yes, they were. Some equally spontaneous letters from listeners. I love them. I've kept some of them. I should be able to read some of them to you, you know, really. I've kept a few of these most precious letters on file, still upstairs, and I've carried them around the world with me because they mean an awful lot to me.
I mean, you know, it was funny. We were just in your office maybe about an hour ago, and I walked in and I went, you were apologizing, saying, oh, excuse the mess, and the only thing I can think was, this looks like my place.
Well,
organized chaos.
Well, that's exactly what I called. I called Taipei, and people said, you know, what's it like? Well, they usually did. What's it like?
Organized chaos.
This is organized chaos. Yes, and I guess that's why I get on so well with the locals, and why I'm still around here after maybe 15 years or more, right?
So let's move now forward a bit. How did you end up in Taipei?
Well. gosh, you want me to go into all this, Keith? I mean, you know, some of it could be quite...
Well, you see, we have to go into it because somebody from Belgian radio asked me to transcribe it. They're following you still.
Well, that's fine. They can hear this because there's nothing that I'm going to say that in any way can be offensive. I don't think so. And no one could possibly take it because basically I'm just not that sort of person. I don't want to have any hard memories because I had there's so many scintillating times and memories that I had, like the mail and mobile monologues, because, you know, being able to take and being allowed to take the studio around the country to, you know, some of the prejudicial or the how can I say, the negative part aspects that were involved in that too, but nevertheless they gave me the opportunity to do this. And it was experimental in many ways. It was possibly the first time that it had happened, and that's all I have to show for it, because unfortunately all my archive tapes went the way of all, well, not exactly the way of all flesh, you know, but thank you, Samuel Butler, but I archived them in one of my friend's basements in Belgium, and he could have been decent enough to have told me that wasn't actually his basement, you know, so this stuff, or somebody told me they saw many of my old tapes being sold, you know, on a flea market in Brussels. So if anybody has actually come by any of these old tapes, you know, I'd be very glad to repossess them. But I want to go back to when you said, you know, how I come here. Well, you know, everything went kind of as it does for most people, kind of very wrong after my big and I'm glad you give me time, you give me an opportunity to in a sense kind of redeem myself, because I felt very sad. Sad, S-A-D. Not mad or bad or anything like that, because everything I did, everything we did, you know, Jeff White was here in 1988. We had a convention, a sort of DXL convention, a DX's convention in Antwerp. And that went very well, I think. Some of the oldies, including my good friend George Wood. George Wood. Hi, George. You know, he's still in Sweden, I understand, right? And, you know, it was a great success because people like George, and I don't think Ian was there, because George and Ian and Bob. And Jeff, you know, the life and soul of every occasion, Bob and Jeff, they were all there, and a few others that I could control off the top of my head now. But it was a wonderful, it was a jamboree, a DX jamboree. But, you know, many of those DSs were interested in content too. Alas, by the time I got around to doing the same thing at the International, I'm afraid, you know, not so much my ego, but my aspirations or my intentions and ambitions had grown so much bigger, and I wanted to do something on a really grandiose scale. So, you know, I went ahead and hired the International Congress Center in Berlin. You know, to do something like this, you know, costs an arm and a leg, as I discovered. And happily, there were many DXs, I thought at the time, you know, people had to pay to be there. Maybe DXs don't like to do that. But, you know, many did. They came. And we tried to put on a show for them. And we tried to do something again, I think, experimental to a large extent, by having a kind of interactive online, you would call it now, but some kind of simultaneous broadcast. We had the Voice of America come in. I think Kim Andrieliot came online. We had Bob's panel. We had a panel of so-called shortwave experts. You know, in some of them being exported, like myself, yes, landed up here. You know, more by accident than design. But on this panel, and we went out live. So I think a lot was achieved with that. But, you know, the DXs themselves, and there was certainly nothing underhanded about that. You know, a little profit had to be made on hotel rooms, etc., you know, to pay for everything. But once again, I mean, someone had to pay for it, and, you know, that ended up, you know, being yours truly. Maybe I shouldn't be saying this, but that's the way it was. But you had, you know, kind of, you had a few mealy-mouthed people there that, you know, turned this whole thing into a very, you know, I shouldn't be saying this, should I? But it all became a kind of, this became rather obsessive, and people thought that I was just, you know, screwing them, you know, the DXs, anyhow, that element. And when we were standing, I mean, it was historic, in a restaurant that was in a tower, I seem to remember it, or on nearby the hall, overlooking the Berlin Wall. And even then, I mean, the Berlin Wall was still standing. Can you believe it? And the searchlights were still beaming, you know. And people were still screaming, you know, on the other side of it to get out, obviously, you know. And Axel Springer, which I'd first visited as a very young journalist, you know, about 10 years previously. And, you know, we were standing up there, people like myself and Bob and Ian, you know, standing up there and saying, my gosh, it's because of what we're trying to achieve here today, you know, and because of everything that shortwave broadcasting should be, international broadcasting should be, it's this that's going to be this interactive, getting people, you know, talking to one another at a personal level across, you know, thousands of miles through this medium, that, you know, we're going to bring down repressive regimes like the one on the other and a war like this, you know. And begad, you know, just 6 months later, of course, it fell down, not possibly because of anything we were saying, but it was almost prophetic. I think that was very significant for myself personally. I found that very significant. And then, you know, you had this bunch of, I'm sorry, you know, harem scaring people there that were just, you know, asking for QSO cards and things. No, not everybody did that, you know, and were complaining about the price of another bottle of wine, you know, after we'd gone through, I'm sorry, and there were a few broadcasters, professional broadcasters doing the same thing, and I don't care if they're listening now, it doesn't matter. They were supposed to be very much part of us. And they were doing just that, you know, complaining about, I thought, what a damn waste again, you know. So here you were, really, and to a sense, in a sense, I mean, I didn't tuck my tail between my legs and run, but basically, and I can very well say it, that was the kind of, what could you say, the finally kind of brought me to my knees, quite honestly, an event like that, because I thought it could lead, or it could optimistically and idealistically, very idealistically, lead to new horizons in international broadcasting and shortwave broadcasting. And by then I was running my own company. I had my own company, you know, communications media company in Belgium, as it so happens. But, you know, it was all this pettiness, I remember the people from, should I mention the stations? I won't mention this, or should I? Yeah, of all places, another country that I love very much, Turkey, you know, and somehow the Turks and the Germans, you know, just had it in for what we were trying to do, you know, and very mealy-mouthed and very, very mean, ultimately, and the whole thing kind of, for that reason, I think, didn't achieve what some of us were or would like to have seen happen.
So it was that the point when you said, you know what, I've had enough of this stupidity and dealing with these ludicrous people. I'm just going to walk away from it.
It was, quite honestly, it was. That was. And I say it in, you know, in all sincerity, I was just fed up because, you know, the meanness of it all, quite honestly. And I thought, if this is the kind of medium I'm going to try and have anything to do with the help of some of my good friends whom I know went through some of the same, I don't want to use that word, but some of the same agonies, you know, and you know, then it just wasn't worth it. It really wasn't worth it. And it's certainly not worth losing any more money or you know, tears over it. So I just got out.
So when you got it, you came to Taipei.
And I wanted to go, and quite honestly, for other reasons too. Yes, I wanted to, for a few reasons which I wouldn't want to recount. I decided just to up and out and go as far as I leave and go as far as I possibly could from what was then Europe, you know, and I ended up here. But which is as you yourself know, it's quite unlike anywhere else on earth, isn't it?
You know, it's very strange. It's one of those places that, you know, I've met other foreigners here, and you've probably met them as well. They come here and they really don't like it for whatever reason it is. Mm-hmm. But yet there's other foreigners that come here, like yourself, myself, and other ones that I can think of, that you come here and there is something special about this place. There is something special about it, even though, as we described it as being organized chaos at times, there is something very special about it.
Well, it's almost tangible, isn't it? Almost tangible. And I think, apart from the organized case, maybe, as you say, maybe that's the reason why people like us manage to survive here, you know, kind of everything goes. And
you know, I was describing this to somebody, and I said, here I find a lot more freedom to do what you want than, let's say, in Canada or even in Europe.
Well,
you can experiment with things here more so.
Well, it's kind of more, it's so much more laid back, but things do get done. It's organized in only the, of course I can say it, you know, in the Chinese way, in the Oriental way. It could not work in Europe, of course it couldn't, you know, but things get done. Look at the bureaucracy you've got to put up, the red tape you've got to put up with in Europe or America today. You know, a friend of mine who is an American was telling me just now, you know, to build just he lives in Oregon, I think, but, you know, his daughter, everyone, she goes to a school, quite a posh one, in the state, and, you know, she's got to get from one side of the road to another. Now, to do that, you've got to build special pedestrian crossings, and it would cost anyhow some ginormous sum of money, like $40,000, you know. And there's, you know, when you could, as they would do in Taiwan, you know, they would find a solution that overnight someone goes going to put two very very stark yellow lines across the pavement or something like that, you know, and save yourself $40,000 and just get rid of here. And yeah, sorry, my wife, Sophie. So
hello, say hi, Sophie.
Hi.
That's David's wife.
And whereas, you know, in we're coming up in a moment for dinner, right? Another glass of wine. I could do with that, yes. Maybe I'm getting a little, yeah.
You know, it's funny because this is the kind of place where if you're having a problem with some government organization or whatever, I mean, it's also very red tape like everywhere in the world. But here it's easy. I find it easier to deal with. You go there and you say, look, I apologize for this. I didn't know. And they go, oh, it's okay. Just do it anyway.
Actually, you're very right because, yes, there are laws and they're probably many more. There's a lot more red tape here than in some of the places we know better, we have known in the past. Certainly in a place like Belgium, which is full of red tape. Europe is full of red tape. The European Economic Community, you know, it's red tape personified. I don't know. But the fact is here, yes, there are rules within rules and wheels within wheels, and they go on churning. In the gyre, the falcon does not, yeah, the falconer, you know, but the point is, everybody breaks them. Nobody can, and sometimes that can be both hilarious, it can be tragic too, as you well know. I mean, look, you know, there, you know, more than 1,000 scooter riders, you know, were lost on the roads, you know, last year, and they put warning signs up, you know, any one of the freeways here, down here in Peitou, every month, there's this, you know, a fluorescent, LED board up that says, you know, in Chinese and sometimes in English, that warns you, you know, in the last 2 weeks, you know, 10 people have been killed on this road, you know, in either a scooter or in a car on four wheels.
But that's so the tragic thing. But yet, yeah. The easy things that maybe in the West a lot of people find a headache to deal with, here is very easy. Even though the rules are there, there's... It's different. It's just different.
Solutions are always easy.
Yes.
There are always solutions. I mean, we're talking about the international broadcasting, you know. Solutions are always there. It's the people, you know. It's the personal, the personality, you know, the individual, the official that stands in the way. I mean, you know, we talk about, oh, for instance, Belgian radio in those days, I remember. Oh, we, you know, our listenership is so small. We can only, you know, we only have a small audience in Africa or wherever it was there they were trying to beam to. I mean, I'm not much of a technical man, you know. And I said, but why in the hell don't you just, you know, turn your antenna around? I mean, turn your antenna around and make it kind of omnidirectional or something, you know, and you have a bigger audience to broadcast a few more times during the day. But, you know, so it all comes back to that, you know, the authority, you know, the individual personality that happens to get in the way. But solutions are always possible.
You know, but I think one of the things that makes Taiwan very special is something that people may not know overseas, but Taiwan is a very new democracy. Democracy has been here less than 15 or 20 years, so they're still going through a lot of their growing pains, especially with bureaucratic things that people take for granted in the West. And I think that may also be part of it as well.
Well, it makes yes, possibly. I mean, these are growing pains, but yes, democracy, Chinese style. I mean, you know, the last president now, I think, is a guest of, you know, I was going to say, his
in prison.
His message, his government, certainly a guest of the state, isn't he, right? You know, for doing some rather undemocratic things. But that was perfectly normal. I mean, the party before had done much the same thing. And I guess, you know, that's just the way it is. Not only here, heaven's alive, it's the same thing in Europe or in America. I mean,
so you've been here for 15 years.
Right.
And when you first came here, what was it like for you? Were you thinking, oh, I'm happy to get out of Europe, I'm happy to get out of radio, and I want to do something different?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't happy, obviously, to get out of Europe or get out of radio. No, there were too many things that really bound me into Europe, and they still are, obviously. Family and, you know, the culture and there's, of course, and I'll never stop being in love with Europe and with everything that Europe, I think, stood for, possibly. Not everything that the present Europe probably stands for or is trying to be. I'll be quite honest with you. I mean, you know, I was really quite shocked when I was over there just a month ago, what had become even in a couple of years. You know, I was in the Baltic States, I have a long, long relationship with the Baltic States, and a very, very meaningful one too. One of the things I've done is brought orchestras out from Europe, or an orchestra and young musicians, because I've tried in my own small way, in my own small way out here, you know, to encourage and to foster the careers of young musicians and the classical musicians. And, you know, I'm going off track a little, the Baltic States. What Europe's become? I remember when I first went up there, and in Latvia, to be exact, 15 years or slightly more than that ago. And, you know, heavens, it was totally quite another world for me. And I made some very close friends there, still are very dear friends. And I remember then, of course, for anyone coming from the East, as I did, or from Western Europe, then it was just after the collapse of the Soviet Union and after the small revolution, of course, which is one of the reasons why I wound up at the radio station in the first place, because I saw those pock marks in the walls, bullet marks, as they turned out to be, on the Dom Square. And, you know, gosh, it was so... still kind of, I don't know, how would you say, not naive, but innocent, and it was even cheap, you know, financially for any one of us visiting. For my local friends, of course, it wasn't really that way, but even although they earned a pittance of what we were possibly earning in the West then, or even earning in the East, a pittance, really, it was a pittance, you know. They could still get by. I go back now 15 years later, you know, as part of the EEC, part of the EC, and heavens alive, even although they might be earning, you know, three or four times as much, it's difficult to get by. And heavens alive, I find that the cost of living, you know, in those countries, or certainly the country that I have had most of dealings with, like Latvia, you know, was even, I would say, a good 10, 15, 20% more than in Central Europe, you know.
Well, when you're paying 4 euros for a coffee, there's something wrong.
Well, I would say so. I mean, one of the reasons why I beat a hasty retreat and came back here after just over a month, because, you know, I was just kind of, you'd think we'd be a little more aware of these things, but it seemed just kind of, you know, otherworldly to me. Mm. So is this the way the world's heading? Well, I think the world generally, you know, is heading towards implosion. But nevertheless, I am an optimist and I remain convinced that maybe we'll get it right at the end. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, let me ask you, you know, since we've been, you know, meeting up on Sundays and talking a lot about radio, how much interest would you have in making guest appearances on the Happy Station show and coming back every now and again and talking to the audience?
I'd be delighted.
I'm putting you on the spot, I know.
No, Keith, well, I mean, what an honor, absolutely. And even to be on your program tonight and as an interviewee after some of the illustrious names that I know have already appeared with you on the show. Yeah, well, Keith, what can I say to that? You know, I'm kind of speechless and very touched, very moved. I would be, yes, I'd be more than ready to do that. It would give me a chance also to extrapolate on a few of the things we touched on this evening. I mean, you asked me about Taiwan. There's a lot more I can say about Taiwan. I'd love to be a kind of tour guide, in fact, to Taiwan. I've traveled around the island. I haven't yet cycled around the island. I will be doing that. I should have done that just before during the summer, but I will do that. If anybody wants to join me, they're very welcome. Very welcome. I have many good buddies here in Taiwan who are cycling, passionate about cycling, and so am I. And you see, Keith, we're surrounded by the hills, the mountains. I like to live between the mountain and the sea. Over there, the straits, the sun has just gone down. You've just seen that huge ochreous, you know, the glow on the horizon. The sun just sunk, you know.
Well, that's actually one thing about the area of Beitou, right, which is not far from Danshui. It has a very beautiful sunset. And at nighttime, now this is something that I cannot see at my place at night, but the stars. The stars here are much brighter than in my place in Banqiao.
Is that right? Yes. It is very clear, very, very clear, very transparent. But yeah, not even like that. It's certainly not like that in Beijing, is it?
No, there's cloud cover all the time.
Living there, yeah. But it is here. And we're very lucky to live on the mountain. A marvelous vantage point, which is the reason why, one of the reasons why I live here. I mean, I can get on my bicycle and in 5 minutes I'm up into the hills. And you're very lucky, you'll be amazed. Even the climatologically, how it can change in just, you know, 10 minutes or 15 minutes. I ride up over this hill, which is only about 1 kilometer, and it could be raining on the other side of it. You know, it could be bright sunshine. Here I could be sitting in the glow of a warm autumnal day and just ride over the hill and you know, I'm into cloud and rain again. We often do that sort of thing. And yeah, I'd like to talk more about that. But this is a kind of Pandora's box of earthly delights. And it really is, entire Taiwan. I mean, you must know. Did all good things come out of Pandora's box? Not all good things, but you know, but I can say that, right? You'd be amazed. Taiwan, I mean, when you come to think of it, you know, only, it's a small country, 24 million people. You know, it's 24, that's twice the population, really. Holland, isn't it? I mean, Holland's the most densely populated country in Europe, about 50 million. And it's twice the population of Belgium, right? And yet, you know, the majority of that population lives on the east coast, the industrial west coast of the island. And the east coast is very sparsely populated. And then, of course, there are the mountains. These mountains that undulate all the way from north to south and that I want to ride over. Undulating over the mountain, I like that. Cycling.
When you're cycling, what we should do is we should call you up when you're cycling. You can do little pieces on the show.
We could. I'd be delighted to do. Yes, and maybe we could. How could I be in touch with you? I could be in touch with you along the way. We could do a kind of round around the island. You know, kind of cycling monologues or something. You know, where I could go around the island and then I could stop and have a telephone call with you, chat on Skype with you. You know, from places like Hualien, from Taidong, from Kenting, from Kaohsiung, etc., yeah. I'd be delighted to do that. Yeah.
Well, David, thank you very much.
Sorry, Keith, now I really do need some wine. Right, something to drink, yeah.